of the lonesome time. Sing the song, children.
I can stop wanting you.
It's useless to say.
I'm Cheryl Kay, host of the Jazz Disturbance on WGXC, 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears in upstate New York. The Jazz Disturbance features jazz and other upstate New York. The Jazz Disturbance features jazz and other improvised music. Tune in on the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 5th Sunday of each month from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on 90.7 FM, wavefarm.org/listen, tune in, and on the Wave Farm Radio app on your smartphone. Playlists are posted at facebook.com/CKDisturbance.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Friday Night Racer of Hartsdale, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC's public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Good morning. You're listening to Good Night Norman with your host, Norman, on WGXC 90.7 FM in your Hudson dial, WGXC.org around the world. It is now 12:03 a.m. and it's the 15th of November. William Burroughs, a junkie, a queer, a wife murderer, and a scribbler, said that writing is plagiarism. That a writer is a reader shouldn't surprise anybody. And in preparing this social media post promoting tonight's show, I learned and plagiarized the following. Woodblock printing was used widely throughout East Asia 1,500 years ago. It started in China in antiquity as a method of printing on textiles, later on paper. The earliest examples that survive in China date from around 220 AD. The advantages of printing were apparent to the Buddhists. By the 7th century, they were using wood blocks to make apotropaic documents. This is a word that means a document that wards off spells, or anything that's apotropaic will ward off a spell. A document, an herb, the middle or pinky finger of some dead ancestor, who knows. Anyways, they made these documents only as ritual items that weren't circulated widely or even meant for the public. Instead, they buried them in consecrated ground. The earliest example of this type of printed matter is a fragment of a Dharani, or Buddhist spell, written in Sanskrit and unearthed in a tomb in Chian. It is called the Great Spell of Unsullied. It was printed using woodblock around 650 AD. The first book known to be printed was printed in using woodblock on the 11th of May in the year 868. It was the Chinese Buddhist Diamond Sutra. I also learned, because I was encouraging people to read to their family and friends on holidays in that social media post of mine, that Kartik Purnima is celebrated on the full moon this week, and on that day, you should fast until you see the full moon. If you're Hindu, Sikh, or Jain, you already know this. It's the day that Shiva, in his form as Tripurantaka, or killer of Tripurasura, killed Tripurasura. So read out loud to somebody then. Okay, enough of that smarty pants stuff that I didn't know myself but found out because somebody else wrote it down. I'm going to read something by Jorge Luis Borges. Born in 1899 in Argentina at Buenos Aires and dead at Geneva, Switzerland in 1986. The story that I'm going to read is entitled The Immortal. It begins with a citation from Francis Bacon, his Essays, volume 58. Solomon saith, there is no new thing upon the earth. So that as Plato had an imagination, that all knowledge was but remembrance. So Solomon giveth his sentence, that all novelty is but oblivion. The Immortal. In London, in the first part of June 1929, the antique dealer Joseph Cartaphilus of Smyrna offered the Princess of Lucange the 6 volumes in small quarto of Pope's Iliad, published somewhere around 1715 to 1720. The princess acquired them. On receiving the books, she exchanged a few words with the dealer. He was, she tells us, a wasted and earthen man with gray eyes and gray beard of singularly vague features. He could express himself with fluency and ignorance in several languages. In a very few minutes, he went from French to English, and from English to an enigmatic conjunction of Salonika Spanish and Macau Portuguese. In October, the princess heard from a passenger of the Zeus that Cartaphilus had died at sea while returning to Smyrna, and that he had been buried on the island of Ios. In the last of the Iliad, she found this manuscript. The original is written in English and abounds in Latinisms. The version we offer is literal. 1. As far as I can recall, my labors began in a garden in Thebes, Hecatompylos, when Diocletian was emperor. I had served without glory in the recent Egyptian wars. I was tribune of a legion, quartered in Berenice, facing the Red Sea. Fever and magic consumed many men who had magnanimously coveted this steel. The Mauritanians were vanquished. The land previously occupied by the rebel cities was eternally dedicated to to the Plutonic gods. Alexandria, once subdued, vainly implored Caesar's mercy. Within a year, the legions reported victory, but I scarcely managed a glimpse of Mars' countenance. This privation pained me, and perhaps caused me precipitously to undertake the discovery through fearful and diffuse deserts of the secret city of the immortals. My labors began, I have related, in a garden in Thebes. All that night I was unable to sleep, for something was struggling within my heart. I arose shortly before dawn. My slaves were sleeping. The moon was of the same color as the infinite sand. An exhausted and bloody horseman came from the east. A few steps from me, he tumbled from his mount. In a faint, insatiable voice, he asked me in Latin the name of the river bathing the city's walls. I answered that it was the Egypt, fed by the rains. "Another is the river I seek," he replied sadly, "the secret river which cleanses men of death." Dark blood surged from his breast. He told me that his homeland was a mountain on the other side of the Ganges, and that on this mountain it was said that if one traveled to the west where the world ends, he would reach the river whose waters grant immortality. He added that on its far bank the city of the immortals rises, rich in bastions and amphitheaters and temples. Before dawn, he died, determined to discover the city and its river. Interrogated by the executioner, some Mauritanian prisoners confirmed the traveler's tale. Someone recalled the Elysian plain at the end of the earth, where men's lives are perdurable. Someone else, the peaks where the Pactolus rises, whose inhabitants live for a century. In Rome, I conversed with philosophers who felt that to extend man's life is to extend his agony and multiply his deaths. I do not know if I ever believed in the city of the immortals. I think that then the task of finding it was sufficient. Flavius, proconsul of Getulia, gave me 200 soldiers for the undertaking. I also recruited mercenaries who said they knew the roads, and they were the first to desert. Later events have deformed inextricably the memory of the first days of our journey. We departed from Arsinoe and entered the burning desert. We crossed the land of the troglodytes, who devour serpents and are ignorant of verbal commerce, that of the Garamants, who keep their women in common and feed on lions, that of the Augils, who worship only Tartarus. We exhausted other deserts where the sand is black, where the traveler must usurp the hours of night, for the fervor of day is... From afar, I glimpse the mountain which gave its name to the ocean. On its sides grows the spurge plant, which counteracts poisons. On its peak live the satyrs, a nation of fell and savage men given to lewdness. That these barbarous regions, where the earth is mother of monsters, could shelter in their interior a famous city seemed inconceivable to all of us. We continued our march, for it would have been dishonor to turn back. A few foolhardy men slept with their faces exposed. They burned with fever. In the corrupted water of the cisterns, others drank madness and death. Then the desertions began. Very shortly thereafter, mutinies. To repress them, I didn't hesitate to exercise severity. I proceeded justly, but a centurion warned me that the seditious, eager to avenge the crucifixion of one of their number, were plotting my death. I fled from the camp with the few soldiers loyal to me. I lost them in the desert amid the sandstorms and the vast night. I was lacerated by a Cretan arrow. I wandered several days without finding water, or one enormous day multiplied by the sun, my thirst, or my fear of thirst. I left the route to the judgment of my horse. In the dawn, the distance bristled up into pyramids and towers. Intolerably, I dreamt of an exiguous and knitted labyrinth. In the center was a water jar. My hands almost touched it. My eyes could see it. But so intricate and perplexed were the curves that I knew I would die before reaching it. 2. When finally I became untangled from this nightmare, I found myself lying with my hands tied in an oblong stone niche no larger than a common grave, shallowly excavated into the sharp slope of a mountain. Its sides were damp, polished by time rather than by human effort. I felt a painful throbbing in my chest. I felt that I was burning with thirst. I looked out and shouted feebly. At the foot of the mountain, an impure stream spread noiselessly, clogged with debris and sand. On the opposite bank, beneath the last sun or beneath the first, shone the evident city of the immortals. I saw walls, arches, facades, and fora. The base was a stone plateau. 100 or so irregular niches, analogous to mine, furrowed the mountain and the valley. In the sand there were shallow pits. From these miserable holes and from the niches, naked, gray-skinned, scraggly, bearded men emerged. I thought I recognized them. They belonged to the bestial breed of the troglodytes, who infest the shores of the Arabian Gulf and the caverns of Ethiopia. I was not amazed that they could not speak and that they devoured serpents. The urgency of my I calculated that I was some 30 feet from the sand. I threw myself headlong down the slope, my eyes closed, my hands behind my back. I sank my bloody face into the dark water. I drank just as animals water themselves. Before losing myself again in sleep and delirium, I repeated inexplicably some words in Greek. Quote, "The rich Trojans from Zelia who drink the black water of the Asipos," unquote. I do not know how many days and nights turned above me, aching, unable to regain the shelter of the caverns, naked on the unknown sand. I let the moon and the sun gamble with my unfortunate destiny. The troglodytes, infantile in their barbarity, did not aid me to survive or to die. In vain I begged them to put me to death. One day, I broke my bindings on an edge of flint. Another day, I got up and managed to beg or steal. I, Marcus Flaminius Rufus, military tribune of one of Rome's legions, my first detested portion of serpent flesh. My covetousness to see the immortals, to touch the superhuman city, almost kept me from sleep. As if they penetrated my purpose, neither did the troglodytes sleep. At first I inferred that they were watching me, later that they had become contaminated by my uneasiness, much as dogs may do. To leave the barbarous village, I chose the most public of hours, when almost all the men emerge from their crevices and pits and look at the setting sun without seeing it. I prayed out loud, less as a supplication to divine favor than as an intimidation of the tribe with articulate words. I crossed the stream clogged by the dunes and headed toward the city. Confusedly, two or three men followed me. They were, like the others of their breed, of slight stature. They did not inspire fear, but rather repulsion. I had to skirt several irregular ravines, which seemed to me like quarries. Obfuscated by the city's grandeur, I had thought it nearby. Toward midnight, I set foot upon the black shadow of its walls, bristling out in idolatrous forms on the yellow sand. I was halted by a kind of sacred horror. Novelty and the desert are so abhorred by man that I was glad one of the troglodytes had followed me to the last. I closed my eyes and awaited without sleeping the light of day. I have said that the city was founded on a stone plateau. This plateau, comparable to a high cliff, was no less arduous than the walls. In vain I fatigued myself. The black base did not disclose the slightest irregularity. The invariable walls seemed not to admit a single door. The force of the sun obliged me to seek refuge in a cave. In the rear was a pit. In the pit, a stairway which sank down abysmally into the darkness below. I went down. Through a chaos of sordid galleries, I reached a vast circular chamber. There were 9 doors in this cellar. 8 led to a labyrinth that treacherously returned to the same chamber. The 9th, through another labyrinth, led to a second circular chamber equal to the first. I do not know the total number of these chambers. My misfortune and anxiety multiplied them. The silence was hostile and almost perfect. There was no sound in this deep stone network, save that of a subterranean wind, whose cause I did not discover. Noiselessly, tiny streams of rusty water disappeared between the crevices. Horribly, I became habituated to this doubtful world. I found it incredible that there could be anything but cellars with 9 doors and long branched out cellars. I do not know how long I must have walked beneath the ground. I know that I once confused in the same nostalgia the atrocious village of the native city amid the clusters. In the depths of the corridor, an unforeseen wall halted me. A remote light fell from above. I raised my confused eyes. In the vertiginous, extreme heights, I saw a circle of sky so blue that it seemed purple. Some metal rungs scaled the wall. I was limp with fatigue, but I climbed up, stopping only at times to sob clumsily with joy. I began to glimpse capitals and astragals, triangular pediments and vaults, confused pageants of granite and marble. Thus, I was afforded this ascension from the blind region of dark interwoven labyrinths into the resplendent city. I emerged into a kind of little square, or rather, it was surrounded by a single building of irregular form and variable height. To this heterogeneous building belonged the different cupolas and columns. Rather than by any other trait of this incredible monument, I was held by the extreme age of its fabrication. I felt that it was older than mankind, than the earth. This manifest antiquity, though in some way terrible to the eyes, seemed to me in keeping with the work of immortal builders. At first cautiously, later indifferently, at last desperately, I wandered up the stairs and along the pavements of the inextricable palace. Afterwards I learned that the width and height of the steps were not constant, a fact which made me understand the singular fatigue they produced. This palace is a fabrication of the gods, I thought at the beginning. I explored the uninhabited interiors and corrected myself. The gods who have built it have died. I noted its peculiarities and said, the gods who built it were mad. I said it, I know, with an incomprehensible reprobation which was almost remorse, with more intellectual horror than palpable fear. To the impression of enormous antiquity, others were added, that of the interminable, that of the atrocious, that of the complexly senseless. I had crossed a labyrinth, but the knitted city of the immortals filled me with fright and repugnance. A labyrinth is a structure compounded to confuse men. Its architecture, rich in symmetries, is subordinated to that end. In the palace I imperfectly explored, the architecture lacked any such finality. It abounded in dead-end corridors, high, unattainable windows, portentous doors which led to a cell or pit, incredible inverted stairways whose steps and balustrades hung down. Other stairways, clinging airily to the side of a monumental wall, would die without leading anywhere. After making two or three turns in the lofty darkness of the cupolas. I do not know if all the examples I have enumerated are literal. I know that for many years they infested my nightmares. I am no longer able to know if such and such a detail is a transcription of reality or of the forms which unhinged my nights. This city, I thought, is so horrible that its mere existence and perdurance, though in the midst of a secret desert, contaminates the past and the future, and in some way even jeopardizes the stars. As long as it lasts, no one in the world can be strong or happy. I do not want to describe it. A chaos of heterogeneous words, the body of a tiger or a bull in which teeth, organs, and heads monstrously pullulate in mutual conjunction and hatred can perhaps be approximate images. I do not remember the stages of my return amid the dusty and damp hypogea. I only know I was not abandoned by the fear that when I left the last labyrinth, I would again be surrounded by the nefarious city of the immortals. I can remember nothing else. This oblivion, now insuperable, was perhaps voluntary. Perhaps the circumstances of my escape were so unpleasant that on some day, no less forgotten as well, I swore to forget them. 3. Those who have read the account of my labors with attention will recall that a man from the tribe followed me as a dog might up to the irregular shadow of the walls. When I came out of the last cellar, I found him at the mouth of the cave. He was tracing clumsily and erasing a string of signs that, like the letters in our dreams, seem on the verge of being understood and then dissolve. At first, I thought it was some kind of primitive writing. Then, I saw it was absurd to imagine that men who have not attained to the spoken word could attain to writing. Besides, none of the forms was equal to another, which excluded, or lessened, the possibility that they were symbolic. The man would trace them, look at them, and correct them. Suddenly, as if he were annoyed by this game, he erased them with his palm and forearm. He looked at me, seemed not to recognize me. However, so great was the relief which engulfed me, or so great and fearful was my loneliness, that I supposed this rudimentary troglodyte looking up at me from the floor of the cave had been waiting for me. The sun heated the plain. When we began to return to the village, beneath the first stars, the sand burned under our feet. The troglodyte went ahead. that night, I conceived the plan of teaching him to recognize and perhaps to repeat a few words. The dog and the horse, I reflected, are capable of the former. Many birds, like the Caesar's nightingales, of the latter. No matter how crude a man's mind may be, it will always be superior to that of irrational creatures. The humility and wretchedness of the troglodyte brought to my memory the image of Argos, the moribund old dog in the Odyssey. And so, I gave him the name Argos, and tried to teach it to him. I failed, over and over again. Conciliation, rigor, and completely in vain. Motionless, with lifeless eyes, he seemed not to perceive the sounds I tried to press upon him. A few steps from me, he seemed to be very distant, lying on the sand like a small, ruinous lava sphinx. He let the heavens turn above him from the twilight of dawn till that of evening. I judged it impossible that he not be aware of my purpose. I recalled that among the Ethiopians it is well known that monkeys deliberately do not speak, so they will not be obliged to work, and I attributed Argos' silence to suspicion or fear. From that imagination, I went on to others, even more extravagant. I thought that Argos and I participated in different universes. I thought that our perceptions were the same, but that he combined them in another way and made other objects of them. I thought that perhaps there were no objects for him, only a vertiginous and continuous play of extremely brief impressions. I thought of a world without memory, without time. I considered the possibility of a language without nouns, a language of impersonal verbs or indeclinable epithets. Thus, the days went on, dying, and with them the years. But something akin to happiness happened one morning. It rained, with powerful deliberation. Desert nights can be cold, but that night had been fire. I dreamt that a river in Thessaly, to whose waters I had returned a goldfish, came to rescue me. Over the red sand and black rock I heard it approach. The coolness of the air and the busy murmur of the rain awoke me. I ran naked to meet it. Night was fading. Beneath the yellow clouds, the tribe, no less joyful than I, offered themselves to the vivid downpour in a kind of ecstasy. They seemed like Corybantes, possessed by the divinity. Argos, his eyes turned toward the sky, groaned. Torrents ran down his face. Not only water, but, I later learned, tears. Argos, I cried. Argos. Then, with gentle admiration, as if he were discovering something lost and forgotten a long time ago, Argos stammered these words. Argos, Ulysses' dog. And then, also without looking at me, this dog, lying in the manure. We accept reality easily, perhaps because we intuit that nothing is real. I asked him what he knew of the Odyssey. The exercise of Greek was painful for him. I had to repeat the question. Very little, he said, less than the poorest rhapsodist. It must be 1,100 years since I invented it. 4. Everything was elucidated for me that day. The troglodytes were the immortals. The rivulet of sandy water, the river sought by the horsemen. As for the city whose renown had Ganges, It was some 9 centuries since the immortals had raised it. With the relics of its ruins, they erected in the same place the mad city I had traversed, a kind of parody or inversion, and also temple of the irrational gods who govern the world, and of whom we know nothing, save that they do not resemble man. This establishment was the last symbol to which the immortals condescended. It marks a stage at which, judging that all undertakings are in vain, they determined to live in thought, in pure speculation. They erected their structure, forgot it, and went to dwell in the caves. Absorbed in thought, they hardly perceived the physical world. These things were told me by Homer, as one would speak to a child. He also related to me his old age and the last voyage he undertook, moved, as was Ulysses, by the purpose of reaching the men who do not know what the sea is, nor eat meat seasoned with salt, nor suspect what an oar is. He lived for a century in the city of the immortals. When it was raised, he advised that the other be founded. This should not surprise us. It is famous that after singing of the War of Ilion, Homer sang of the War of the Frogs and Mice. He was like a god who might create the cosmos and then create a chaos. To be immortal is commonplace. Except for man, all creatures are immortal, for they are ignorant of death. What is divine, terrible, incomprehensible, is to know that one is immortal. I have noted that in spite of religions, this conviction is very rare. Israelites, Christians, and Muslims profess immortality, but the veneration they render this world proves they believe only in it, since they destine all other worlds in infinite number to be its reward or punishment. The wheel of certain Hindustani religions seems more reasonable to me. On this wheel, which has neither beginning nor end, each life is the effect of the preceding and engenders the following, but none determines the totality. Indoctrinated by a practice of centuries, the Republic of Immortal Men had attained the perfection of tolerance, and almost that of indifference. They knew that in an infinite period of time, all things happen to all men. Because of his past or future virtues, every man is worthy of all goodness, but also of all perversity, because of his infamy in the past or future. Thus, just as in games of chance, the odd and even numbers tend toward equilibrium, so also wit and stolidity cancel out and correct each other, and perhaps the rustic poem of the Cid is the counterbalance demanded by one single epithet from the eclogues, or by an epigram of Heraclitus. The most fleeting thought obeys an invisible design and can crown or inaugurate a secret form. I know of those who have done evil so that in future centuries good would result, or would have resulted in those already past. Seen in this manner, all our acts, but they are also indifferent. There are no moral or intellectual merits. Homer composed the Odyssey. If we postulate an infinite period of time with infinite circumstances and changes, the impossible thing is not to compose the Odyssey at least once. No one is anyone. One single immortal man is all men. Like Cornelius Agrippa, I am God, I am hero, I am philosopher, I am demon, and I am world, which is a tedious way of saying that I do not exist. The concept of the world as a system of precise compensations influenced the immortals vastly. In the first place, it made them invulnerable to pity. I have mentioned the ancient quarries which broke the fields on the other bank. A man once fell headlong into the deepest of them. He could not hurt himself or die, but he was burning with thirst. Before they threw him a rope, 70 years went by. Neither were they interested in their own fate. The body for them was a submissive domestic animal, and it sufficed to give it every month the pittance of a few hours of sleep, a bit of water, and a scrap of meat. Let no one reduce us to the status of ascetics. There is no pleasure more complex than that of thought, and we surrendered ourselves to it. At times, an extraordinary stimulus would restore us to the physical world. For example, that morning, the old elemental joy of the rain. Those lapses were quite rare. All the immortals were capable of perfect quietude. I remember one whom I never saw stand up, had nested on his breast. Among the corollaries of the doctrine that there is nothing lacking compensation in something else, there is one whose theoretical importance is very small, but which induced us, toward the end or the beginning of the 10th century, to disperse ourselves over the face of the earth. It can be stated in these words. There exists a river whose waters grant immortality. In some region, there must be another river whose waters remove it. The number of rivers is not infinite. An immortal traveler who traverses the world will finally, someday, have drunk from all of them. We proposed to discover that river. Death, or its allusion, makes men precious and pathetic. They are moving because of their phantom condition. Every act they execute may be their last. There is not a face that is not on the verge of dissolving like a face in a dream. Everything among the mortals has the value of the irretrievable and the perilous. Among the immortals, on the other hand, every act and every thought is the echo of others that preceded it in the past with no visible beginning, or the faithful presage of others that in the future will repeat it to a vertiginous degree. There is nothing that is not as if lost in a maze of indefatigable mirrors. Nothing can happen only once. Nothing is preciously precarious. The elegiacal, the serious, the ceremonial do not hold for the immortals. Homer and I separated at the gates of Tangier. I think we did not even say goodbye. 5. I traveled over new kingdoms, new empires. In the fall of 1066, I fought at Stamford Bridge. I do not recall whether in the forces of Harold, who was not long in finding his destiny, or in those of the hapless Harald Hardrada, who conquered 6 feet of English soil or a bit more. In the 7th century of the Hegira in the suburb of Bulak, I transcribed with measured calligraphy and a language I have forgotten and an alphabet I do not know, the 7 adventures of Sinbad and the history of the city of bronze. In the courtyard of a jail in Samarkand, I played a great deal of chess. In Bikaner, I professed the science of astrology, and also in Bohemia. In 1638, I was at Kolozsvár, and later in Leipzig. In Aberdeen in 1714, I subscribed to the 6 volumes of Pope's Iliad. I know that I frequented its pages with delight. About 1729, I discussed the origin of that poem with a professor of rhetoric named, I think, Giambattista. His argument seemed to me irrefutable. Irrefutable. On the 4th of October, 1921, the Patna, which was taking me to Bombay, had to cast anchor in a port on the Eritrean coast. I went ashore. I recalled other very ancient mornings, also facing the Red Sea, when I was a tribune of Rome, and fever and magic and idleness consumed the soldiers. On the outskirts of the city, I saw a spring of clear water. I tasted it, prompted by habit. When I came up the bank, a spiny bush lacerated the back of my hand. The unusual pain seemed very acute to me. Incredulous, speechless, and happy, I contemplated the precious formation of a slow drop of blood. Once again, I am mortal, I repeated to myself. Once again, I am like all men. That night, I slept until dawn. After a year's time, I have inspected these pages. I am certain they reflect the truth, but in the first chapters, and even in certain paragraphs of the others, I seem to perceive something false. This is perhaps produced by the abuse of circumstantial details, a procedure I learned from the poets, and which contaminates everything with falsity, since those details can abound in the realities, but not in their recollection. I believe, however, that I have discovered a more intimate reason. I shall write it, no matter if I am judged fantastic. What I have narrated seems unreal because in it are mixed the events of two different men. In the first chapter, the horseman wants to know the name of the river bathing the walls of Thebes. Flaminius Rufus, who before has applied to the city the epithet of Hecatompylos, says that the river is the Egypt. None of these locutions is proper to him, but rather to Homer, who makes express mention in the Iliad of Thebes Hecatompylos, and who in the Odyssey, by way of Proteus and Ulysses, invariably says Egypt for Nile. In the second chapter, the Roman, upon drinking the immortal water, utters some words in Greek. These words are Homeric, and may be sought at the end of the famous catalogue of the ships. Later, in the vertiginous palace, he speaks of a, quote, reprobation which was almost remorse. These words belong to Homer, who had projected that horror. Such anomalies disquieted me. Others of an aesthetic order permitted me to discover the truth. They are contained in the last chapter. There it is written that I fought at Stamford Bridge, that I transcribed in Bulak the travels of Sinbad the Sailor, and that I subscribed in Aberdeen to the English Iliad of Pope. One reads inter alia, in Bikinar I profess the science of astrology and also in Bohemia. None of these testimonies is false. What's significant is that they were stressed at all. The first of them seems proper to a warrior. But later, one notes that the narrator does not linger over warlike deeds, but he does over the fates of men. Those which follow are even more curious. A dark elemental reason obliged me to record them. I did it because I knew they were pathetic. Spoken by the Roman Flaminius Rufus, they are not. But they are spoken by Homer. Strange that the latter should copy in the 13th century the adventures of Sinbad, another Ulysses, and should discover after many centuries in a northern kingdom in a barbarous tongue the forms of his Iliad. As for the sentence containing the name of Bikinar, one can see that it was fabricated by a man of letters, desirous, as was the author of the ship catalogue, of exhibiting splendid words. Ernesto Sabato suggests that the Giambattista who discussed the formation of the Iliad with the antique dealer Cartaphilus is Giambattista Vico. This Italian defended the idea that Homer is a symbolic character after the manner of Pluto or Achilles. When the end draws near, there no longer remain any remembered images. Only words remain. It is not strange that time should have confused the words that once represented me with those that were symbols of the fate of he who accompanied me for so many centuries. I have been Homer. Shortly, I shall be no one, like Ulysses. Shortly, I shall be all men. I shall be dead. Postscript, 1950. Among the commentaries elicited by the preceding publication, the most curious, if not the most urbane, is biblically entitled A Coat of Many Colors, published at Manchester, 1948, and is the work of the most tenacious pen of Dr. Nahum Cordovero. It comprises some 100 pages. The author speaks of the Greek centos, of the centos of late Latinity, of Ben Jonson, who defined his contemporaries with bits of Seneca, of the Virgilius Evangelisms, of Alexander Ross, of the artifices of George Moore, and of Eliot, and finally of the, quote, narrative attributed to the antique dealer Joseph Cartaphilus, end quote. He denounces in the first chapter brief interpolations from Pliny's Historia Naturalis, in the second from Thomas de Quincey's Writings, Volume 3, in the third from an epistle of Descartes to the ambassador Pierre Chanu, and the fourth from Bernard Shaw, back to Methuselah. He infers from these intrusions or thefts that the whole document is apocryphal. In my opinion, such a conclusion is inadmissible. When the end draws near, wrote Cartaphilus, there no longer remain any remembered images. Only words remain. Words. Displaced and mutilated words. Words of others, where the poor pittance left him by the hours and the centuries. Catherine the Lacemaker by Marcel Schwab. Catherine the Lacemaker, Lady of the Night. She was born toward the middle of the 15th century in Rue de la Parcheminerie, near Rue Saint-Jacques, during a winter so cold that the wolves ran through Paris in the snow. An old woman, her nose red beneath her hood, took her in and raised her. Early on, she played under the cover of the porches with Perronnette, Guillemette, Isabeau, and Jean Tonne, who all wore little tunic dresses and dipped their small reddened hands into streams to snatch pieces of ice. The girls also spent their time watching the boys, who cheated the passers-by foolish enough to play a game of nine men's mo- and beneath the awnings they eyed the tripe in their tubs, and the long chubby sausages, and the great iron hooks from which the butchers would hang quarters of meat. Near Saint-Benoît-le-Bétonné, where the scriptoriums are housed, they listened to the scratching of the quills, and in the evenings they blew out the candles under the noses of the clerks through the dormer windows of the shops. By the Petit Pont, they taunted the fishwives and fled toward Place Maubert as fast as their little legs would carry them, hiding in the recesses of Rue des Trois Portes. Then, seated along the edge of the fountain, they would chatter until the night's fog set in. Thus, Catherine spent her earliest years until the old woman taught her to sit before a lace pillow and patiently intertwine the threads of the many bobbins. Later on, she lived off her trade, Jean Tonne having become a bonnet maker, Perronnette a washerwoman, and Isabeau and Guillemette, the happiest of them all, a sausage maker, with her little crimson face that gleamed as if it had been rubbed with fresh pig's blood. As for those who had played Nine Men's Morris, they had already undertaken sundry other initiatives. Some were students atop the Montagne Saint-Genevieve, while others shuffled cards at the Trou Perrette. Others still were clinking pitchers of wine from Aunis at the Pomme de Pin. And then there were those who argued at the Hôtel de la Croce Margot. At noon, you could see them by the entrance to the tavern on Rue aux Fèves, and at midnight, they left by the door to Rue aux Juifs. As for Catherine, she continued to interweave the threads of her lace, and on summer evenings, she would take in the fresh air on the bench outside the church, where it was acceptable for her to laugh and enjoy idle talk. Catherine wore a light écru shirt and a green-tinted surcoat. She was completely mad for women's attire, hating nothing so much as the padded bourrelet which marked that a girl was not of noble lineage. In much the same way she loved money, testons and blancs of silver, and above all, golden écu. This is how it came to pass that she got involved with Cassin Cholet, a foot sergeant at the Châtelet. Under the cover of his duties, he made money however he could. Often she would eat her dinner in his company at the Hôtellerie de la Mule, across from the Mathurin Church. And after having eaten, Cassin Cholet would go steal chickens on the other side of the ditches that demarcated Paris. He would bring them back, tucked away under the folds of his tabard, and would sell them for good money to La Machecrou, Arnaud's widow, the beautiful poultry merchant who lived near the Petit. No sooner said than done, Catherine quit her job as lacemaker, for the old woman with the red nose was by that time rotting away in a mass grave at the Cimetière des Innocents. Cassin Cholet found a small room to rent for his companion not far from Trois Pucelles, and there he would come to pay her late-night visits. He did not forbid her to display herself in the window, her eyes darkened with charcoal, her cheeks painted with white lead, and all of the pots, cups, and fruit dishes from which Catherine offered food and drink to those who paid her well had been stolen from the Cher, or the Signe, or the Hôtel du Plat d'Étain. Cassin Cholet disappeared one day, having first pawned Catherine's dress and belt at Trois Lavandières. His friends told the lacemaker that he had been beaten against the back of a cart and chased through the Porte Baudoyer and out of Paris by order of the provost. She was never to see him again, and alone, no longer having the heart to do regular work, she became a whore and took shelter where she found it all over the city. At first she waited by the entrances to the inns, and those who were familiar with her would take her back behind the walls, under the Châtelet, or up against the Collège de Navarre. Then, when it grew too cold, an obliging old woman took her to the bathhouse, where the mistress gave her shelter. There she lived in a stone room, her bed a covering of green reeds upon the floor. She was called by the name Catherine the Lacemaker, although she no longer made lace. Sometimes she was accorded the freedom to roam the streets, on the condition that she would return by the time people tended to. And Catherine would wander past the glovemaker's shop and that of the bonnet maker, and often she would remain a long while to envy the blood-red face of the sausage woman laughing among her cuts of pork. Then she would return to the bathhouse, which the mistress lit at dusk with candles that burned red, dripping and oppressive behind the dark windows. Eventually, Catherine grew tired of living enclosed in a square room. She took to the roads, and soon enough she was no longer a Parisian nor a lacemaker, but rather one of those women who haunt the areas outside the cities of France, sitting on the cemetery stones and offering pleasure to those who pass by. Those girls never go by any name other than one suitable to their face, and Catherine was given the name Snout. She walked alongside the meadows, and during the evening she kept watch along the edges of the country lanes, her mournful white face visible between the rows of blackberry bushes. Snout learned to endure the fear that came over her in night amidst the dead her legs trembling as her feet brushed past the tombs. No more testones or blanks of silver, no more golden accus. She survived as do the poor on bread and cheese and her bowl of water. She had equally unfortunate friends who whispered to her from afar, snout, snout, and she grew quite fond of them.